From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 1-800-NOW-OPEN or open.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On the third anniversary of the war in Iraq, we noted that the media were asking, is it civil war yet? This week, they edged closer to the answer.
With not enough boots on the ground and a civil war either happening now or perhaps about to,
how should American forces change their civil war, if not already deep into a civil war?
Repeatedly, I can't send my kids to school because they have to cross sectarian lines. The marketplace blew up 3 days ago. These people say this feels like civil war.
As the civilian death toll climbs to more than 100 a day, many observers declare that Iraq is, in fact, already in the midst of an all-out civil war. Among them were former Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi, Congress members from both parties, and numerous columnists and military analysts. Public opinion polls suggest that most Americans agree, almost two-thirds of them, according to a CNN poll this week. But the Bush administration does not agree. And apart from opinion columns and magazine pieces, news outlets largely decline from making the declaration themselves, placing any mention of civil war in the mouths of sources or qualifying it with phrases like on the brink of and risks descending into. We ask New York Times Deputy Foreign Editor Ethan Bronner why.
Our policy is not to label it a civil war. We recognize and describe elements of civil war in what's going on in Iraq. We tend to call it sectarian conflict, sectarian violence. Civil war to us feels like a stage of conflict that we are not convinced Iraq is in yet. It may feel occasionally like it's there, that it puts its foot there sometimes, but it doesn't stay there. And so it seems to us that if we were to call it a civil war, then we will have labeled it something that we're not convinced it is. And in that sense, it's not useful.
People in government understand, as you do, that civil war is a very loaded term and that there are policy implications if one were to be declared there. Many who defend the current action say if we left now, the country would fall into civil war. If the country already is in civil war, it changes the calculus on whether or not we ought to be staying. Is it just the Times wants to stay out of that argument?
I don't think that that's a fair description of why we're keeping the term out of the paper the way we do. That is to say, it's not a conversation we've had where we say, damn, we really don't want to be used by one side or the other in this dispute. Again, it just feels like labeling that's not all that useful, because let's say we agree that there is a civil war, and if we leave, there'll be a worse civil war, a full-blown civil war. Does that change the argument about whether we should stay or leave? I don't think so. I mean, another person could say there is severe sectarian violence going on in Iraq, and if the United States leaves, it will get far more severe so that it becomes actually a civil war. It seems hard for me to believe that it would make a big difference in the political discussion.
What would it take for the Times to decide that it is a civil war?
I don't think I could answer that, you know, sort of we need to see X, Y, and Z. But I think that broadly speaking, if it seemed that the sides of conflict in Iraq had separated themselves into full-blown militias slash armies and war was a full-time occupation in Iraq, that would be a civil war. And I imagine that's when we would start calling it that. At the moment in Iraq, after all, every day people go to school, people go to work. There is awful violence, but I don't know that the warfare between the sides is the thing that defines every moment of life. Of course, it threatens life, and it isn't a horrible part of life, but it doesn't seem to us to be the overriding element of every day and every hour there.
On the other hand, it doesn't have to affect every single part of life for there to be a civil war underway.
Does it not? I don't know.
Well, I mean, even in the American Civil War, people went about collecting their crops in various parts of the country and managed to survive.
No, I mean, I understand what you're saying. I guess it seems to us that, you know, at a certain point, it will, if in fact it grows to the point where the sides have divided into clearly defined groups fighting one another. I mean, the government, for example, is a mix of Sunni, Shia, and Kurd. Is it a player in this civil war that others see? It's not clear to me.
Let me just do something that might be a little unfair, Ethan, and throw this list of people at you who have said they are in the midst of civil war. Former Iraqi PM Iyad Alawi, Senator Chris Dodd, Senator Chuck Hagel, your own reporter Dexter Filkins, and apparently the majority of the American people, according to a USA Gallup poll this month.
You know, it is not that I'm here to say under no circumstances is this a civil war. The question is, do we want to use it as a term of art in our coverage day in and day out? I mean, there is a certain conservatism or a cautiousness inherent in writing news copy at the New York Times. We're not eager to sort of lead the debate, but to try to reflect it as best as possible. And my guess is that we could construct an equally long and impressive list of people who say we're not quite there.
All right. Ethan, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke.
Ethan Bronner is deputy foreign editor for the New York Times.
If civil war is still a judgment call for editors, one term they can agree on is insurgency. In the pages of The Times and other news outlets, it has become the common currency to describe the source of the violence in Iraq. But Larry Diamond, a senior fellow at the conservative Hoover Institution and a former advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad, says that the term insurgency only captures a fraction of what's occurring there now.
There is an insurgency in the Sunni-based areas to the what they see as an American occupation and an American intent to dominate the country and the new political order. So in that sense, I think insurgency is an entirely appropriate word. The problem is that it only captures one dimension of the violence in Iraq today, and the other dimension is a deepening sectarian conflict purely among Iraqis that I think cannot be given any other term except civil war, really.
In a way, I guess there's three wars going on simultaneously. There's the insurgency against the government, there's the insurgency against the American occupation, and then on top of all of that, these spasms of grotesque violence that seem to have nothing to do with the American occupation per se.
And unfortunately, that doesn't begin to exhaust the list. You also have a very considerable level of opportunistic criminal violence that interacts with, but it's not purely identical with, these other three forms. And you have a growing amount of internal conflict within the Shia between different political parties, militias, and local factions for control of territory and for control over oil and its trade. You know, this leads to the decentralized nature of the conflict, which makes it even more difficult to control.
Why is the administration so dead set against the invocation of this term?
Well, I think that they may fear, and perhaps not without some reason, that if we use the term civil war, it will frame the situation in Iraq as being comparable to, say, Lebanon at its worst moments, and that the American people may decide at that point that this is hopeless, that we can't be in the middle of a civil war, and therefore it will generate intensified American domestic pressure for withdrawal. That's my guess.
But should that dictate for the media whether or not they call a thing by its name?
I personally have no problem as a scholar and an American citizen with the media recognizing the obvious reality that when, on average, Iraqis are dying at an annual rate of 30 to 40,000 a year in an internal conflict, that's civil war. And I think what the media might do editorially is say, look, Iraq is in a civil war. It's pretty obvious. The challenge now is how to diminish the violence and stabilize the country so that the United States can get out. That if we simply withdraw unconditionally with no change in the parameters of the situation or in our policy, the civil war will intensify catastrophically for Iraqis, for the region, and for our own national interest, and everybody will lose. I think there's something actually perhaps to be gained from starting to use the language in terms of analytic clarity and sharpening our thinking about how we need a different, more focused strategy for diminishing and eventually resolving this civil war.
All right. Well, Larry, thank you very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Larry Diamond is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Former U.S. Ambassador to Croatia Peter Galbraith, a harsh critic of the administration's actions in Iraq, is now a paid advisor to the regional government of Kurdistan, which he believes should be one of three autonomous regions of a fully partitioned Iraq, South, Central, North, Shiite, Sunni, Kurd. He believes that failing to call the conflict a civil war props up false hopes that an indigenous Iraqi security structure can ever ensure the country's stability.
The Iraqi army and the Iraqi police are dominated by the radical Shiite militias. They are responsible for the death squads. They are partisans in a civil war.
Clearly, the administration is heavily invested in the idea that there is no civil war afoot in Iraq. And it's entirely possible that some media trepidation about using that word is the accusation that it is somehow taking sides against the administration.
I think it's the job of the media to provide objective information and objective analysis. And I've spent a lot of time talking to the reporters in Iraq, and frankly, every one of them believes that it's a civil war. And if that's the case, then that's what they ought to call it. If the media continues to portray this as a conflict between a government and an insurgency, it is mischaracterizing the conflict and preventing the kind of debate I think we need about the different strategies in Iraq, given that it's in a civil war.
All right. I want to take great care not to put words in your mouth here, but it seems to me that if I follow the logic of what you're saying, that if the media continue to refrain from invoking this term, that the violence inevitably will continue and that there actually will be blood on our hands. Have I overstated the case?
The media is going to be doing a great disservice to the American people and to the American government and to the American soldiers in Iraq who are on a mission that cannot succeed if they do not provide objective analysis and if they do not call the situation as it is. Pulling its punches will get people killed.
All right, Ambassador Galbraith, thank you very much.
Well, very good talking to you.
Former Ambassador Peter Galbraith is the author of The End of Iraq, How American Incompetence Created a War Without End. He spoke to us from Kurdistan.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Paul Salopek is a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner who has been praised for his exhaustive reporting and evocative prose, and who has reported from some of the most dangerous and miserable places on Earth. In August, he was in the Darfur region of Sudan when he was arrested, accused of espionage. Salopek was on a brief leave from the Chicago Tribune in order to write a multi-part series on life in the vast Central African savanna for National Geographic. He'd written stark reports from Sudan before, and based on experience, he decided to cross the border without a visa, planning to be there only for about 2 days. 2 hours later, he was arrested and ultimately imprisoned for 34 days. Salopek says on this assignment, he was following one of the few leads he'd gotten about good news in the region.
We were traveling on a road to a village that people were going to rebuild. Basically a positive story on a fairly dismal humanitarian catastrophe. We were stopped by a militia patrol of Darfurian rebels who had switched sides and joined the Khartoum government in a peace deal. And these individuals captured us, took some of our electronic equipment, and a few days later turned us over to the government forces.
And before they turned you over, were you beaten, abused? How did they treat you?
Well, the treatment from them was a bit harsh, but it got continually better once we were passed into the hands of the Sudanese.
And from that point, it was 34 days of incarceration of various kinds in various places under charges that you were a spy. Where did this come from?
This surprised me as much as anybody. Additionally so, because all three of us, my chatting colleagues, were charged with the same charges, and one was just a driver. I think where it came from was, apparently under Sudanese law, there are two levels of espionage charges. One is intentional and one is unintentional. I've never had it clearly explained to me what unintentional espionage is, but that's apparently even if you're under the suspicion of gathering any information without permission in Sudan. So I guess reporters doing their jobs in war zones would fall under that rubric. They also found notes that I had, interviews with refugees, with humanitarian aid workers, and some internet maps that I downloaded of the border region.
Yeah, let's not gloss over the fact that you were in Sudan illegally. You hadn't obtained a journalist's visa for entering the country. Why?
Sudan has opened up its doors a bit in the last 5 or 6 years and become an easier place to work in. There are now, to my knowledge, at least one and maybe two or three Western journalists based in Khartoum doing their job there, which you wouldn't have heard of, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago. It has very brave Sudanese reporters working there all the time. And there is some debate in the Sudanese press itself. However, Darfur and before Darfur, the civil war in the south has always been problematic. It's a difficult, remote area to get to. And if you attempt to get a visa to cover it, they frequently take weeks, if not months, if you get them at all. And then once you do go through official channels with a visa, your job is often thwarted by your travel being restricted or actually meddled with by the secret police, scaring away sources or just making your life generally difficult to collect information freely.
You have at least one story to finish. Did the Sudanese tell you get out and stay out, or will you try to go back into the country again?
Well, Sudan is one of the most important stories in Africa for many reasons. I mean, it's a microcosm of Africa. It's geographically set out like Africa, a mostly ethnic Arab North and a mostly ethnic African South. And it's hugely important because of its position as sort of a crossroads to the Middle East, and it's got resources like oil that the whole world wants. So I would love to go back to Sudan, obviously through official channels this time. When I did leave Khartoum, Sudanese, at least at that occasion, said that I was welcome to come back. So I'll be delighted to take them up on that offer.
There has been enormous amounts of coverage of Darfur without it seeming to have had any effect either on the political situation on the ground there, nor in the public's mind here. I mean, I remember so vividly President Clinton talking about the Rwanda genocide, saying never again. Do you see any evidence that more coverage is going to change the way the world reacts to this ongoing catastrophe?
It's a hideously complicated conflict that goes back ultimately to struggles over resources that then is overlaid with ethnic and tribal rivalries and then overlaid yet again with political agendas at the national level and indeed the international level. So I think it's not just writing a story a day or a story a week about Darfur, but explaining it correctly. Just how difficult and how complicated life is there. And I think that allows policymakers then to explain their positions to their constituents, to the public, and go about the very, very difficult job of trying to sort things out. So I've got to believe that, yeah, more coverage will help.
In the midst of the efforts to free you, Congressman Chris Shays of Connecticut, apparently trying to assuage the Sudanese government, said that you, quote, did a very foolish thing coming into the country without a visa, and he knows that. He knew he made a mistake. Did you make a mistake, or did you just do what you had to do to get the story?
You know, Congressman Shays, whom I'm immensely grateful to, I won't take issue with his statement in the sense that I clearly made a mistake by putting myself and my two Chadian colleagues in danger. I take full responsibility for that. I know that having covered many, many conflicts, when I have colleagues who either A, get captured or worse, get killed in combat around the hotels afterwards or in the cars that journalists travel in after these incidents happen, we express our great shock and condolences, but we also parse what went wrong, in quotes. But it's a defense mechanism because there's an element of luck in all of this, that bad luck can be the deciding factor between freedom or captivity or between life and death.
All right, Paul. Well, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Paul Salopek is a twice Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent for the Chicago Tribune.
Recent stories in the news have more to do with each other than you might think. The first, in the Toledo Blade, was about two competing measures on the Ohio ballot, one supported by R.J. Reynolds to loosen restrictions on smoking in public places, the other backed by the American Cancer Society to tighten them. The second news story, reported everywhere, notes that California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has signed a law to cut emissions back to 1990 levels out of concern for global warming. What do secondhand smoke and global warming have in common? George Monbiot, a professor at Oxford University and columnist for The Guardian, writes in his new book, Heat, that in the early 90s, tobacco companies decided to challenge new findings on secondhand smoke by launching a campaign to discredit the scientific studies on global warming.
They realized that if passive smoking was the only thing they campaigned on, their fingerprints would be all over it. So they were advised not to campaign only on passive smoking, but to link it with other issues which bore on regulatory matters. And the first of those issues was global warming.
What's the evidence that you have to document this campaign?
The great thing about one of the big lawsuits against the tobacco companies is that one of the outcomes was to force the companies to put their archives on public record. And so you can go through the source material documenting exactly what their strategy is. And in this case, they say, we're going to set up this so-called grassroots coalition. We are going to call it the Advancement for Sound Science Coalition. We're going to tell it to campaign against junk science, which is any science we don't like, and to campaign in favor of sound science, which is any science we do like.
Now, you describe what we call AstroTurf, fake grassroots campaigns. Mm. So what did they do beyond AstroTurf?
There's a document which says we should launch this away from the big media outlets because they're quite likely to smell a rat, whereas elsewhere where journalists are assumed to be more naive, we think we'll be able to pass this off okay. It was a cleverly run campaign. Unfortunately, journalists right across the US were far too credulous, and the messages were picked up by many US politicians as well as by the public.
These PR firms and the grassroots organizations and the think tanks repeating the line of this Philip Morris coordinated campaign, they weren't necessarily lying, were they? You write that they might just have been selecting and highlighting the research that suited them.
The great majority of what they did was selection rather than invention. And they would cherry pick research results completely out of context and suggest that these research results showed that climate change wasn't happening. or indeed that passive smoking didn't cause any adverse health effects. Whereas if you look at the science as a whole, it showed a very clear pattern of climate change and a clear pattern of adverse health effects caused as a result of secondhand smoke. But in some instances, they did circulate information which was just plain wrong and which had no source.
Well, if the goal was to muddy the waters for the issue of passive smoking by muddying the waters on global warming, did it work?
Certainly, the muddying of the waters on global warming has been extremely successful, and I would suggest that it's been more successful than the muddying of the waters on passive smoking, because certainly in the US, more authorities have taken action on passive smoking than they have on climate change.
You aren't suggesting by your article, though, that Philip Morris took charge on muddying the waters on global warming, do you? I mean, certainly Exxon and the other big oil companies had a fair hand in all of that.
Well, that's absolutely true. But the point here is that one of the campaigns which was by far and away the most central to corporate-funded climate change denial, the Advancement for Sound Science Coalition and junkscience.com and the other things that it spawned, was actually started by Philip Morris rather than by Exxon, and Exxon only came in later.
When you look at how the media have tried to deal with the situation of, say, global warming, we've noted quite a lot on this program that a false equivalency has been injected into the argument, the sense that there are some scientists that think one thing and some scientists think another, and you've got the appearance of balance when, in fact, most scientists think one thing and only a very few scientists think the other. Are we still dealing right now, do you think, with this false equivalency when it comes to discussing global warming, or have we finally gotten over it and accepted that there is a consensus on the issue?
While there is no substantive debate taking place among scientists about whether man-made climate change is happening or about whether it represents a very serious threat to many of the world's people, in the media that debate is still going on. What it reflects is this very concerted effort by corporations to cast doubt on the science.
George, thank you very much.
That's my pleasure. No trouble.
George Monbiot is a professor at Oxford University and columnist for The Guardian. His new book is called Heat.
The coverage of science often is subject to manipulation, and certainly not just by corporations. Vincent Kiernan, science writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education, has found that science journals themselves pose a problem when they embargo stories they release to the press. An embargo is an arrangement between journalists and their sources that enables reporters to receive information in advance as long as they promise to hold it until an agreed-upon date. The reason is that science stories are complicated and reporters may need to contact labs and researchers and generally study up before they report the results. Embargoes cost reporters scoops, Kiernan says, but they also prevent everybody from being scooped.
So that way the journalists all know that they won't have the story first, but they also won't have the story last. The theory is that science and medical journalists need some extra time to research and understand a story, to check it out, to speak to a variety of experts around the world who may or may not be easy to reach.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. But your book goes to some lengths to point out that there are holes in the theory. Tell me basically what's wrong with embargoed science.
There are lots of problems with embargoed science, but the biggest issue is that it misdirects journalists. It sets up a system by which journalists are given powerful incentives to cover a certain kind of story about science, the latest eureka moment. And those eureka moments come several times each week. And so the journalists are directed toward those stories and away from critical, skeptical coverage of science as an enterprise, with all its fraud, with all its successes, with all the ethical issues. The journalists are directed away from those stories, stories that many in the scientific establishment are perfectly happy to have them not do.
And as your book points out, not only do reporters tend to pay attention to the elite journals, they pay most attention to the articles in those journals that have been pre-selected by the journal publishers themselves as the most significant and which come with accompanying press releases and other information which you call information subsidy.
An information subsidy is not my term. It's a term that has existed in the communication literature for a while. But basically what it refers to is when a source makes it easier for a journalist to cover a story by providing prepackaged information to the journalist. So, for example, when your senator puts out a press release in hopes of luring reporters into writing about whatever the senator is saying, that's an information subsidy. It skews the process of news selection because journalists are not necessarily picking stories based on their inherent importance and newsworthiness. It skews the process by steering journalists toward covering stories that are easier to cover or that are easier to recognize as stories. Lots of very, very good science gets published in many, many journals. There are literally thousands of journals, and journalists monitor 30, 40 if they're lucky, the ones with embargoes. The ones that are not embargoed that also publish very, very good science, like a bunch of geophysical journals, they are largely ignored by journalists.
Let me ask you what would happen if we were in more of a free market of science coverage. Where would reporters go to find stories? And, you know, how would they avoid going down so many blind alleys to report on science that may ultimately turn out to be not very good science at all?
Well, of course, sometimes they report even now on science that may not turn out to be good science at all. The journals are not perfect by any means. Some scientists worry that in an embargo-less world, journalism about science would turn into pack journalism, that scientists would be waylaid at the door of their homes by journalists begging for the latest studies. I think that's entirely overstated. I think a likely consequence is that media outlets would do fewer stories about journal articles. As far as I'm concerned, I think that's an excellent idea. We do far too much news coverage about breaking scientific studies, which may or may not hold up in the long run.
And if I'm the science writer for news organization X, and it's Wednesday, and while I'm digging around, my editor walks up to me and throws a copy of today's Washington Post on my desk and says, "Autism linked to age of the father. Why didn't we have this? What am I supposed to say?"
I would say that study might be important. It might not. Science is made up of many, many dots of findings that together make a pointillist picture. You're upset that we're missing this one dot. I'm working on a story about the picture.
Okay, Vincent, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Vincent Kiernan is a journalism instructor at Clarion University of Pennsylvania and the author of the new book, Embargoed Science.
Coming up, how the bloom came off Tokyo Rose, and a Vietnam soldier DJ dusts off his mic and heads to Iran.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Good morning, Vietnam!
Most radio junkies have heard of Adrian Cronauer, the Armed Forces radio DJ who broadcast from a base on Crete into Vietnam in the 1960s. Unlike the character based on him, played by Robin Williams in the film Good Morning Vietnam, Cronauer always played by the military's rules. Not so Dave Rabbit. Last weekend, we read a fascinating piece in Salon about an old pirate radio show produced by the young Air Force sergeant on a tour of duty in Saigon in 1971, broadcast from a secret room in a brothel with equipment lent from some pals in supply, while other pals operated relays across the country. His programming delighted his comrades with off-color musings on sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and enraged his commanding officers.
If you happen to be down by the Magic Finger Lounge any time tonight, keep away from the Korean at the front door. He's pushing some bad H. I repeat, he's pushing.
That was the voice of 22-year-old Dave Rabbit, not his real name. Now Dave is 57, a relatively staid and stable Dallas dad, who discovered more or less by accident that after a mere 21 days on the air 35 years ago, he remains a bit of a cult figure. And now he's going to resurrect Dave Rabbit, this time from Iraq. Dave Rabbit joins us on the phone just before he ships out on Tuesday from Travis Air Force Base in Northern California. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Travis Air Force Base? Does this mean that the military is actually helping you out this time?
No. We're not using military equipment. We're not using military anything. Do we have guidance from them? Yes. Do we have agreements with them to a degree? Possibly.
You're not saying.
Yeah, that's as far as I take you.
Uh-huh. Now, these are the same people that were after your hide 35 years ago that wanted to maybe even throw you in jail.
Well, you know, the statute of limitations is long since gone on that. You know, I mean, I was violating, you know, the Uniform Code of Military Justice. You know, we were active duty military personnel in a war zone, and our show was not, you know, enjoyed by the ones that were straight-laced and had polished shoes. Our show for the troops in the field, the guys that were laying their lives on the line every single day, and that was our whole reason for being in existence.
We're an underground radio station here, and we say what we feel like saying, and we bring the truth to the first-termers in the Republic of Vietnam. We also bring you hard-acid rock music all through the night.
So what was the nature of the truth that you were offering the soldiers in the field?
What an average 19-year-old believed to be the truth back in the 60s. You know, we didn't believe that it was the same scenario like our fathers fought in World War II. I mean, in World War II, you know, the whole country was just gung-ho, and, I mean, everybody bonded together. It was that kind of thing. It was us against them. In the situation in Vietnam, you know, it was politically motivated. A perfect example is Hamburger Hill. I mean, those guys fought for several days. There were several hundred GIs that were killed. And then 10 days later, they gave the hill up. So all those 400 guys, or whatever the number was, were killed to take a hill that meant nothing. It was a piece of dirt. Unlike World War II, where you're sitting there physically defending our country, our borders and whatever, from the Germans and the Japanese. But we never really came out in the show and said, hey, everybody lay your weapons down, let's go home. What we did is we took the political situation that we had facing us at the time and turned things that would, on the surface, look very negative and made it something funny.
You were distinguishing between the Second World War and Vietnam, and you used the example of Hamburger Hill. I was wondering, do you see Iraq as more like Vietnam?
I think there's a lot of similarities, and the similarities to me are that quagmire. Vietnam was a politically motivated campaign, so was Iraq. The problem is that we didn't have to deal with religious wars in Vietnam. All we had to deal with was discerning whether they're North Vietnamese or South Vietnamese. So the problem in Iraq is not only are these nuts trying to blow up our military people and our allies, They're blowing up their own people. They don't care.
So tell me what the new show is going to sound like. Will you still be playing The Doors, or will you be playing, Ludacris and Tupac?
It's going to be a completely unique show. You know, we're still going to have our hard rock music roots, but there's a lot of flavor in it. It's going to be a mix.
In the old show, you had a regular feature about reading sayings off of latrine walls.
Here's one of them. While I'm home, my wife is my right hand. While I'm away, my right hand is my wife.
Will you have somebody on the bass feeding you those?
We already have the material. We've had people from Iraq telling us stuff for the last several months.
So what do you think, Dave, you can give them that they haven't already got?
Well, you know, here's the deal. A lot of people do shows for entertainment, but they weren't personally ever at risk. They weren't personally ever put to the test of, do I live today or do I not? Any military person that you come across, you can ask them, and they're going to tell you this exact thing. Until you have been there, you don't know. And that's my edge, because I've been there, I've seen it, I've experienced it, I've had those emotions, I've had friends die, I've had ups, I've had downs, I've had depression, I've had all those marvelous things that come with being an American veteran. So that's my edge. That's my edge.
And what is it that you want to say to the men and women you'll be broadcasting to? What specifically is it that you're there to give them?
If I could get one smile, a laugh, or a giggle from somebody and for that 3-hour period of time, give them a chance to sit there and be home, then I've made a successful trip.
I think Dave Rabbit 2.0 is just more of a dad than Dave Rabbit the original.
Yeah, I am. But you know, I tell you, I wouldn't change where I'm at right now, getting ready to do what we're getting to do for all the money in the world. And I'll tell you why. I got an email one day that really brought it home for me. And in the course of this email, the guy is telling me he was in a hospital and he had a leg amputated. And somebody had a copy of one of the shows. And they're playing it. And the guys are laughing and whatever. He said, up until I listened to that show, I really didn't know whether I wanted to continue on. And he said, you gave me a laugh at the time that I most desperately needed it. And he says, I can never thank you enough. And I mean, I'm not kidding you. I get misty thinking about it. Pardon me. It blew me away. I mean, it blew me away. It validated what I did. You understand what I'm saying? I want no money. I want no fame. I want no fortune. You know, everything we're doing is a freebie. We're doing it because we want the validation that we have made a difference in somebody's life. Period.
Dave, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
The pirate radio personality known as Dave Rabbit will broadcast from Baghdad starting next week. You can find him online at daverabbit.podomatic.com.
Iva Tagori died this week, and you probably don't recognize the name, but what if I said Tokyo Rose? In the mythology of World War II, that was the notorious radio propagandist who cooed into the ears of Pacific Theater GIs and tried to crush their morale. There were many such broadcasters, and Tokyo Rose is what the GIs called them, though none of them was an American and none of them actually used the name Tokyo Rose. Certainly not the Japanese-American Iva Tagori, who had traveled to Japan on the eve of war to care for a dying aunt and wound up broadcasting to Allied troops in a very different way. Still, after the war, framed by a journalist and two Japanese businessmen, she was tried and convicted of treason. Years later, the two Japanese businessmen confessed to then-Chicago Tribune Tokyo Bureau Chief Ronald E. Yates that they'd been coached by the FBI for a month on how to implicate Taguri. Yates' 1976 stories led to a full pardon of Iva Taguri, but did little to dislodge her infamy. An infamy based on words uttered many times by others, but never by her.
They would say things like, "All you poor American Marines who are about to land on Okinawa or Iwo Jima or wherever, I feel very sorry for you because the Imperial Japanese Army is sitting there waiting for you in caves and ready to slaughter you when you hit the beaches," that kind of stuff. Of course, Iva never said anything like that ever.
The actual program that she participated in was called the Zero Hour, and her fellow performers were Allied POWs. Producing this under coercion from their Japanese captors. Tell me about the Zero Hour. What was it?
She played records of Glenn Miller, of Benny Goodman, of Artie Shaw, and whatever, and say things, innocuous things like, "Hello, my honorable boneheads of the Pacific. This is your favorite number one enemy. I'm going to sneak up behind you with my nail file.
Greetings, everybody. This is your number one enemy. We're ready again for a vicious assault on your morale. 75 minutes of music and news for our friends, I mean our enemies in the South Pacific. Okay, here's the first blow at your morale. Two guys are singing and singing. Hey, Pop, I don't want to go to work. Please be listening."
The POWs convinced their Japanese overseers that you didn't want to be heavy-handed. You wanted to be very low-key. And they bought that. Well, obviously, that was a very interesting ploy because by getting them to buy that, they didn't have to engage in any really hardcore propaganda or say anything treasonous.
So how did Iva Taguri come to be confused with the Japanese women whose propaganda was so extreme?
In August of 1945, just after the bombs had fallen at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the huge cohort of American and Allied journalists arrive in Tokyo along with General MacArthur and his army. One was Clark Lee, who was a reporter for Hearst newspapers. The other one was a man named Harry Brundage, who was a reporter for Cosmopolitan magazine, in an era when Cosmopolitan was not the same kind of magazine that it is today. And they're looking around. They're trying to find people to interview. They wanted to get to the emperor, Hirohito. They weren't going to get to him. They wanted to get to Tojo, the prime minister. They weren't going to get to him. So they were thinking, well, we'll get Tokyo Rose. So when they began asking around about Tokyo Rose, the answer they got back was, well, there is nobody. Who's that? I don't know who that is. They said it was an American woman. And they said, well, the only American woman I know who was doing any broadcasting was Iva Taguri, but her name's not Tokyo Rose. And they said, that's okay. Have her come over to the Imperial Hotel. We'll interview her. And they offered to pay her $2,000 for her interview. $2,000 in 1945 is the equivalent of about $25,000 today or whatever. And she was trying to get home. And so she ill-advisedly went to the Imperial Hotel. And first of all, they're shocked. She walks in the room, and this is not the Tokyo Rose they were expecting. They expected this Asian beauty, this beautiful woman, and she turns out to be this very short, kind of plain-looking, nondescript young lady. So right away, they were disappointed about that. And then when she starts going into the interview and answers their questions, they begin to see, well, this is not what we were expecting. They wanted to find a spy. They wanted to find this woman who was this Mata Hari of the Pacific, and they weren't getting that.
So they went back to their editors and said, sorry, no story here.
Well, actually, what happened was Clark Lee did file a story, "American Woman Betrays Country for $6.60 a Month." Harry Brundage goes back to Cosmopolitan, and Cosmopolitan says, there's not a story here. Forget about it. And he says, yeah, but I've already promised her $2,000. And they said to him, that's too bad. It's you have to deal with that now. So shrewd man that he was, he calls Iva back and says, would you sign this interview, saying that it's okay, but would you sign it Tokyo Rose for me? And she, not understanding what was going on, she said, sure. So she does it. He runs off to the U.S. occupation authorities and says, here, I have Tokyo Rose's confession. And about 3 days later, she's arrested. And she's incarcerated for a year. And following that year's incarceration, the occupation forces released her, saying she had done nothing wrong. They could find no evidence to hold her on anything. And so she was free to go.
She thought she was free, but the case reared its head again.
Yes, the case came back because word gets out that she's coming back to the United States. And Walter Winchell, at the time a huge force in American radio journalism, gets on the air and says the infamous Tokyo Rose is returning to America. That triggers a huge response from Gold Star mothers. These are mothers who've lost sons in the war. Gold Star mothers start writing letters to the Truman administration saying, how can you let this person come back? She's a traitor, et cetera, et cetera. So President Truman, election year 1948, decides to reopen this case and sends people back to Tokyo to examine it again. And that's when our two men come into the picture, because then they are pulled into this whole conspiracy to help railroad Iva into prison.
You mean the two Japanese men who later told you they lied when they testified against Iva? How many years did she spend in jail?
She spent 6.5 years at Alderson Women's Penitentiary, and she was released in 1956 and then went back to Chicago, where her family had moved from California. Her mother had died in a Japanese internment camp during the war, and her family had moved to Chicago away from California, as did a lot of Japanese Americans, because they felt they had really been badly treated in California, had lost their property, and they wanted to start over again. So she goes back to Chicago to work in her father's import company.
Lived quietly under a cloud until you broke this story. Give me the timeline thereafter.
After the stories appeared, things began to happen. The White House called Tokyo. They wanted more information. And then 60 Minutes picked up the story. Morley Safer interviewed her. The stories and the pressure on the Ford administration eventually caused President Ford in 1977, his last official act in office, to grant her a pardon.
You spent a lot of time talking to Iva Tagori, and she was, in fact, broadcasting during the war on the Imperial Japanese Army airwaves. Mm-hmm. It was a propaganda broadcast. Now, putting aside any subversive clues she may have been embedding in the copy, are you satisfied that Iva Tagori died with an absolute clear conscience?
I think Iva died with a clear conscience. I really do. I know she died with regrets. She told me often she regretted having agreed to do anything with that radio show, because that was her downfall. But she was so eager to be involved with these Americans and to be doing something that they told her would help the American war effort that she agreed to do it. She told me a wonderful story once. She was on the roof of the building she was living in when Jimmy Doolittle's planes came flying over Tokyo, you know, those B-25s. And she couldn't believe it. She looked up and saw the white stars on the blue wings, and she was jumping up and down and waving at them. You know, this was not a traitor. I know what motivated her. And it was really out of patriotism that she did these things, not out of a desire to betray her country.
Dean Yates, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll bet you're sorry now, Tokyo Rose. Sorry for what you've done.
Ronald E. Yates is now dean of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. In 1976, he wrote the article that led to the pardon of the woman incorrectly called Tokyo Rose.
You stuck a knife into the USA.
In January of this year, the World War II Veterans Committee bestowed its award for citizenship on Iva Tagori.
Sorry now, Tokyo Rose. Sorry for what you...
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Alicia Rebensdorf, Michael McLaughlin, and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. And thanks.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.